at 6 p.m. Stay tuned for Radio Extinction Rebellion. Wait, I'm sorry. I got that all backwards. Let's start again. Stay tuned for Extinction Rebellion Radio, and this is still WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online.
You're listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI.
Welcome to the Rebellion.
Welcome to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI 99.5 FM with Matthew Kearney and Elise Lane. Extinction Rebellion is an international movement that uses nonviolent direct action to press for action on the climate emergency. You know, for today, we are continuing our series on militarism and the climate crisis. And our subject today is the intersection of national security and climate change. For this topic, we return to an interview we conducted back in September 2021 for our first militarism episode. And it was an interview we conducted with Professor Nita Crawford. Nita Crawford is chair of political science at Boston University and co-director of the Costs of War Project at Brown and Boston Universities. She is also the author of Pentagon Fuel Use, Climate Change, and the Costs of War, a piece we discussed with her at length in the first militarism episode. Now, if you haven't heard that episode, you know, make sure you check out WBAI's archives for our show and take a listen. It was really, really a powerful piece.
During our conversation with Nita, we asked her a question that we did not end up including in the first show. And that question was about the climate assessment report issued this past summer by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC. You might remember that the report painted a dire picture of our climate present and a dire picture of our climate future should we continue on our fossil fuel burning path of business as usual. Now, of course, we are continuing on that path of business as usual, which is abundantly clear from the empty promises made at November's COP26. COP26 stands for the 26th Conference of the Parties on the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, or UNFCCC. A bunch of countries and fossil fuel lobbyists convened in Glasgow, engaged in a lot of blah, 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 and came back with, among other things, an empty, non-binding promise to phase down, not even phase out, coal use, let alone fossil fuel use in general. Elise and I have spoken at length about the do-nothingness displayed at COP26, a do-nothingness that keeps us on a catastrophic climate path.
Yes, it does. You know, that conversation we had with Professor Crawford about the IPCC assessment became the occasion by which Professor Crawford provided some really, really important observations about national security and climate change, observations which we thought merited an entire show. So take a listen.
In its most recent climate assessment, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reached several frightening conclusions, and it's worth taking a minute to summarize them and then ask you to react to their findings. First, they say it is unequivocal that human influence has warmed the atmosphere, the ocean, and the land. Widespread and rapid changes in the atmosphere, ocean, cryosphere, and biosphere have occurred. Second, the scale of recent changes across the climate system as a whole and the present state of many aspects of the climate system are unprecedented over many centuries and many thousands of years. We have not seen this for millennia, at least. Third, global warming of 1.5 Celsius and 2 degrees Celsius will be exceeded during the 21st century, and maybe more, unless deep reductions in CO2 and other greenhouse gas emissions occur in the coming years. In fact, they now think that 3 degrees Celsius, it would be a best case scenario. So these are just a few of the panel's conclusions. Now, I don't think that the IPCC has ever addressed specifically war emissions and militarism. Given your research on climate change and the cost of war,
What are the consequences, implications of the exclusion of war emissions and militarism from IPCC reports?
Well, first of all, what you described is awful, right? And we're headed there unless we change our ways. I think that one of the reasons why the IPCC has not included a discussion of military emissions is not just that the Kyoto Protocol largely left them out, but it's because there's a different understanding of what security means in this set of actors. Okay, members of the United Nations, you know, climate change concerned community are concerned with ecological security, the health of the planet, the beings on it, the human beings, the animals, the plants. They're concerned with the entire ecosphere, how it operates. And they're talking to the world about the human and other life on the planet that's in jeopardy. And largely, they're not in sort of state-centric security frameworks. These are really two discourses that don't talk very well to each other. And they had the IPCC AR5 assessment report 5, which came out in 2014, had a chapter on human security, sort of laying out what it means to human life that the planet is warming up. And the other actors who talk about the military and security are not in that framework, really. The human security framework is the dominant framework, I think, at the UN and among people at the IPCC. So they're not as concerned because they're thinking differently. It's just two different paradigms.
That's a nice way of framing it. And I wonder still about the consequences of the they're not having a conversation with each other then.
Yeah, I think that there's something else really interesting going on in the last 15 years or so, and that is that members of the national security elite in the U.S. and in Europe have been talking about climate wars, right, and the potential for climate change to cause conflict. And in political science, we talk about this as securitization, taking an issue and saying that it's a national security concern. And that's a way of heightening its importance and saying we need to throw resources at this issue. We need to be alarmed because war is possible. And I think that that discourse is sort of running in parallel with the other discourse I'm talking about. And so what that means is that the military is not talking so much or thinking so much about their emissions role. They're thinking about their role in securing us from potential climate wars or resource wars as water becomes more scarce or food is more difficult to grow as climates become more arid or too wet. And so I think that those two discourses haven't been meeting. What I worry about is that in sort of not paying attention to the military's role in increasing greenhouse gas emissions to the point where the United States military is as large an emitter as a country like Sweden or Denmark, but paying attention to the potential for so-called climate wars, we're actually creating a context where the military has a claim for even more of our resources to help protect us.
Yeah.
And when they start claiming more of our dollar resources or our material resources to build more weapons, that actually makes the problem worse, the larger climate problem worse. And it's not clear to me that the conflicts that could arise from climate stresses are best addressed with military solutions.
In the way you're describing it, it's as though their thinking is locked into a nation state framework and not on a global security framework or a humanitarian framework or a planetary security framework. It's like the nation state not only cages the population, but it cages the structure of thought of the senior leaders at the Department of Defense.
Right. And that's not surprising because that's their job.
That's how they see it.
They're trained to look at these questions in terms of the security of our borders and the interests of the United States as a state. Whereas, of course, you know, on the other hand, governments recognize that climate change has no borders and that this is a global problem. So the two worldviews aren't meshing very well. And, you know, my concern is that we not forget that the first job, our first job should be reducing emissions and then hopefully fostering sequestration by planting trees and, you know, keeping the soil healthy. And the second thing should be preparing for wars, which may or may not happen, right? But we don't want to make the wars more likely that they fear by increasing the pace and the devastating consequences of climate change.
One of my concerns is the way in which the media takes up that securitization framework, so that we're always talking about climate change in terms of the possibility of conflict. Those people are at our borders. What's going to happen next? We should have security. So people are, you know, their resistance to making changes in terms of climate change are like, well, we want to also be protected. We want a strong military because those people are at our border, right?
This is Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney. You are listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI. It's 99.5 FM, New York. This week, we are speaking with Professor Nita Crawford about militarism, the IPCC's most recent climate assessment report, and national security. Professor Crawford is chair of political science at Boston University and co-directs the Cost of War Project at Brown University and Boston University.
So if we were to include militarism and war emissions in climate assessments, such as the IPCC reports, then what kind of recommendations do you think such reports would have to make with regards to war and militarism?
Well, you know, three things. Start counting all the military emissions and enumerate them, including the emissions from military industry. Second, to the extent that you need to, make weapons much more efficient and remove from arsenals those extremely inefficient things like aircraft, which get 4 or 5 gallons per mile, and vehicles, which get 8 miles per gallon, and put more efficient equipment in there. But thirdly, rethink the traditional security concerns. For example, the United States has, since the late 1970s, been focused on protecting access to Persian Gulf oil. And that has meant, you know, the stationing, the permanent stationing, essentially, of thousands of troops and equipment in bases in the Middle East, the militarization of our allies in the Middle East, some of whom have dropped out of being our allies and now are our enemies, like Iran and Iraq, or now Iraq's our friend. And it's also meant that we've had a presence that goes to and fro from the United States in terms of aircraft carriers. Now, all U.S. aircraft carriers are nuclear powered, but every one of the ships, the 10 conventional ships that goes with them, is fueled conventionally with fossil fuel. Also, all the aircraft on those aircraft carriers, we don't necessarily need to have a 24/7 presence of an aircraft carrier in the Middle East to protect access to oil, which we should not be using, cannot be burned, right? And in fact, we are diminishing the U.S. reliance, and have been for the last several years, on Persian Gulf oil, as the United States and its allies have transitioned to renewable energy, and as we found other sources of fuel closer to home. Now, that's not to say that the tar sands from Canada are preferable to Middle Eastern oil. I don't think they are, but reduction by rethinking missions is, I think, the third step that I would encourage.
You're well into answering this question that I had planned next, but I'd like to give you an opportunity to elaborate if you'd like. I mean, how can we think about a low-carbon military, or more radically, a zero carbon military? Sure, there's the utopian scenario of having no more war. But aside from this, oil and gas are convenient for the military readiness that the United States Department of Defense and other nations think that they need. I mean, we're talking about the United States here primarily, but the related technological problems confront any modern military around the world. They still, you know, the other, most other countries that have planes fly them with some version of oil and gas. And yet the planet is in terrible danger from the use of these things. How can we, what's the pathway for the world getting out of a fossil fuel dependent military?
Well, there's, you know, as I said, conversion of equipment, you know, really interesting work is being done on alternative fuels. And in 2016, the Great Green Fleet idea was launched by the Navy. And in 2017, they had these ships. They had a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier. Then they had these conventionally powered ships running on alternative fuel based on some seed that was turned into non-fossil fuel oil. And all that's great. You know, I don't know really what's happened to the Great Green Fleet. They don't seem to be operating the ships on these alternative fuels. Delta Airlines has moved in some cases to food-based fuel. You know, it's like pouring canola oil into your car. It's not quite like that, but it's close. And that's all very exciting. I think that's one way to reduce emissions as long as we have military forces. But what I'm suggesting is much of our force structure was developed around the idea that we had to project power using these fuels. And we have to rethink our force structure, the bases, the political alliances, the military alliances that the United States has, in light of a world where the threat is actually rising sea levels, where the threat is too much heat, where the threat is wild weather, where the things that we care about cannot be secured by people with guns, right? The best security we have is to prevent those things, and then we need to be resilient in our response. So all the resources, the more than $700 billion that we spend annually on the military need to be rethought and repurposed. Let's think for a moment about China, right? Because the next step for the, well, actually it's been the next step since 2000, right?
Yeah.
In 2001, when the Bush administration came into office, they said, okay, we're really going to focus on China. China is a threat. And early on, there were these little skirmishes with the Chinese. And after 9/11, we turned to the post 9/11 global war on terror and invested a great deal of our forces in prosecuting those wars in what are, you know, now 85 countries, 84 countries. But every time they could, the DOD and the defense intellectuals and administrations have said, but China is still a looming threat. And one of the reasons China is supposedly a looming threat is because they have set their sights on Persian Gulf oil. And they've now got a base from which to protect that oil. So what the Chinese are doing is replicating this idea that the way to be secure is to have military forces to protect access to a fuel we should not be using, right? So what we could do instead of increasing our military presence to protect ourselves against the Chinese who are protecting their access to oil in the Persian Gulf, we could work out an agreement with them so that they have a secure sense that they can have access to the oil that they want without the threat of it being cut off. Then they don't have to militarize and mobilize in the Persian Gulf, Middle East more generally. And we don't have to be there to counter their mobilization. Mm-hmm. So I think we need to nip that cycle in the bud. That would be one thing that I would add to this discussion.
That's great. Well, Professor Crawford, thank you for spending time with us.
Oh, my pleasure. And good luck with your work.
You're listening to WBAI's Extinction Rebellion Radio with Matthew Kearney and Elise Lane. So here's an issue that seems to be off climate activists' radar screen: the looming Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Now, as we record this episode in mid-January 2022, Russia has surrounded Ukraine with 100,000 troops. Russian President Vladimir Putin's frustration with NATO's continued efforts to expand by offering membership to Eastern European and Baltic nations has come to a head. Security talks between Russia and NATO to get Russia to de-escalate failed this week. According to the Washington Post, quote, one top Russian official bemoaned a dead-end situation, saying it was pointless to continue after the United States and NATO firmly ruled out Russia's key demands that Ukraine, Georgia, and other nations, including Sweden and Finland, be forever barred from joining NATO, end quote. Now, without getting into the weeds of this crisis, it is important to point out two issues that should focus climate activists' attention. One is the consideration by Washington and its allies to use as a bargaining chip Russian energy giant Gazprom's $15 billion pipeline project. Now, that project, which has yet to receive regulatory approval, will pump gas from the Russian Arctic to Western Europe. Washington and its allies are considering using this pipeline to sanction Moscow should it move on Ukraine. And the sanction, well, that's to delay approval or altogether stop the project in its tracks. And the second issue that should focus our attention is Washington's continued framing of Ukraine's sovereignty as a national security issue.
National security that interacts deeply with the climate crisis, inevitably, right? I mean, that's what that's what prompted you, Elise, to sort of organize this series on climate crisis and militarism, that deep interconnection. As we're sitting here right now, mid-January 2022, we don't know exactly what's going to happen. Will the tanks roll in? Will there be some other mechanism that Russia tries to use to increase its control over Ukraine, even to just straight up militarily conquer the country? It sure looks like an invasion is in the planning, though, maybe even in the near future. So one scenario is that Russia invades Ukraine or otherwise alters its governmental structure, and the U.S. responds with severe sanctions. Russia responds by turning off the gas taps, by refusing to supply. I mean, there's this Gazprom pipeline. Who wants it? Who wants to sanction it? Who wants to stop it? Well, it's we've developed a situation where Russia is one of the major suppliers of fossil fuels to Western Europe, especially to Germany. And that is just fundamental to the strategic considerations that are going on here. Whether the U.S. and its NATO allies will seriously intervene to stop Russia from taking Ukraine. Will they intervene militarily? They've said they won't. So how far will they go economically? How far can they go because Western Europe maybe needs that Russian gasoline? If we weren't in such a fossil fuel dependent situation in the world, this would look very different. Right. The whole complex of how this turns of how this can play out, the amount of leverage that Russia has over former Soviet states, maybe indeed over states in Western Europe itself, pieces of NATO, is fundamentally inflected by the fact that we all depend on fossil fuels. If we transition globally or even regionally to a much more sustainable and less fossil fuel dependent situation, the strategic considerations change. Now, the fundamental problems with militarism remain, but this particular problem with militarism looks very different. So it's the fact that Russia has so much gas and can supply it and does supply it to Western Europe, and it's almost like Western Europe depends on it, is big part of what's allowing this military situation to unfold.
That's right. And it also continues to rationalize the continued use of fossil fuels to continue with these strategic geopolitical machinations on both sides, whether it's the NATO and Washington or Russia. And so we're going to see more fossil fuels burned in order to play these games out.
A machine eating itself, almost.
Exactly.
And they're fighting over, parts of the planet, big parts of the planet. Ukraine's an awfully big country. They're fighting over these big parts of the planet, and yet the planet is burning down. They're focusing on this little piece, and they're missing the planetary scale of the crisis that we're in.
That's right. And let's not forget that the permafrost in Russian territory is really just starting to melt.
been Extinction Rebellion Radio.
I'm Jody Evans for Code Pink Radio Show, presented by WBAI in New York City. And yes, it's that time of the year. It's the time for Fun Drive. It's the time where we open our hearts and thank WBAI for being here for us every day, all year. It's super important for us now to give back. And I've donated to WBAI. I am hoping that you will join me. Remember, this is listener-supported radio. That's you, the listener. It is time for you to pick up your phone and support. You can call 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Or you can go online at WBAI.org and donate to the Tower Fund. The goal this year is to raise enough money in the next 2 weeks that we can pay the entire next year of rent at the beginning of the year, so we don't have the rent hanging over us, so everyone can feel less stress. And we've had such a successful year at, you know, getting ahead of the game. The national management of Pacifica, supporting the team, supporting the producers and the staff. It's been a great year. So we really want to start out 2022 fantastic. So you can help make that happen by calling 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950, or going online at WBAI.org and donating to the Tower Fund. So let's just remember, if there wasn't WBAI, we would be stuck with mainstream media. That is the media that lies to you all day. That is the media that is brought to you by the war machine, that repeats the lies and the disinformation from the State Department that would make you dumber, but not only dumber. That mainstream media works to make the listener inhuman. And what the gift of WBAI is, here our hearts are nourished. We get to hear voices from those around the world. We get to hear the truth about what's happening. We don't get sucked into the stupidity and the war machine. We get to stay connected to what is beautiful and what is human, so that our humanity is enriched. That's a pretty valuable thing. I mean, we should be super grateful to WBAI that they're there and they fight hard to stay there for us every year. So it is time for us, the listener, to pick up the phone and call 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Or you can go online at WBAI.org and donate to the Tower Fund.
This is the mic check for Cat Radio Cafe.
Testing.
Testing.
Tune in to Cat Radio Cafe Tuesday night at 9 here on WBAI.
I'm Janet Coleman.
I'm David Dozer.
The Displaced Playwright on Tuesday, January 25th at 9 p.m. will be joined by players from the Origin First Irish Theater Festival to discuss their star-studded 50th anniversary commemorative reading of Richard Norton Taylor's Bloody Sunday, scenes from the Savile Inquiry, the first performance ever in the United States of this play, about a seismic turning point in the history of Northern Ireland.
Tuesday night at 9 here on WBAI.
Cat Radio Cafe.
Hey, do cats drink coffee?
If it's brewed with fish.